Everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have another great show for you today. My guest will be David George Gordon. He is the award-winning author of a new book called The Eat a Bug Cookbook. And he's also authored 18 other books about whales and cockroaches and tarantulas, etc. And I'm really excited to have him on to talk about the future of eating bugs in our society. Eating bugs is something that is done around the world, but not so much in our country, and we will talk about that. So stay tuned. He'll be on in just a little bit. First, I want to talk to you about some things going on in around the news and, of course, things going on in and around the city that you might want to participate in. First, there was an awards called the Millie Grammy Awards, and that was an award to really kind of measure how much salt is in national food chain restaurants' foods. And the results were shocking. Maybe not so shocking to those of us that really pay attention to the health claims or the health warnings about eating out. But it came, the actually winning dish was from P.F. Chang's Pad Thai with Shrimp. Now, you'd think Pad Thai with Shrimp wouldn't be so bad. Well, it had over 2 days' supply of salt, your salt intake. It had over 5,250 milligrams of sodium, and that's like 26 carry-out packets of salt in one dish. You know, I say it all the time, and I'll just say it again. One of the reasons that we all need to cook at home is that we know what is going into our foods, not only the quality of the ingredients, but how much salt, how much oil, how much sugar. These are all real problems in the American diet, and so much of it is because people are not cooking for themselves and not taking responsibility or, responsibility for what's in their food. And if you leave it to other people and leave it to national chains, their goal is to get you to eat as much as you can with spending as little money as they can. So the quality of the food, for the most part, is not going to be great unless you're going to a very high-end restaurant. And you really have to be careful. So the thing is, if you're cooking almost all of your own meals and occasionally go out, you know, you can get away with it. But so many people these days really are just not cooking. And, you know, I had the pleasure this week of doing a cooking demo at the Long Island Cares Harry Chapin Food Bank. And it was just a room full of people that were just so eager to learn. And all of the people in the room were people that are in charge of various food pantries. And so they are seeing the food that food insecure people are getting. And I actually went shopping in the back of the food bank so that I could use the food, a lot of the food that they get. Of course, I did bring in my own fresh vegetables, but they did have quinoa, they did have brown rice. They had some choices, so it was nice to know that you could make some better choices. They had black beans, they had fire roasted tomatoes, and so I was able to make choices that that were healthy. And I showed them how to make a vegetable quinoto, which is like a risotto except with vegetables in the coconut curry sauce using quinoa. And I also did a vegetarian jambalaya. And jambalaya is a, you know, really full-flavored southern, like New Orleans type of dish that people love. But it usually has sausage in it and pork in it and, you know, smoky flavor. And for the smoky flavor, I use smoked paprika. And it was just great, and everybody was so open and really loved the class, and the questions were great, and it was just really nice to meet the people who are handing out that food to so many of our neighbors who are food insecure. And
You know, it just gives me hope. And at the same time, you know, just twangs my heart that so many people really do struggle with food issues. Also, something else I want to share with you that I wrote about this week in my blog was the Environmental Protection Agency. As you know, the Trump administration is doing everything they can to undo anything good that Obama did. And one of them is trying to undo the Clean Power Act. And the Clean Power Act, you know, is a piece of legislation that really helps clean up our water, our land, and he's trying to undo it. And we really need to sign this petition that I have on my website, or you can go directly to the NRDC, which stands for the National Resource Defense Council's website, and sign their petition to try to save the Clean Power Act. I know signing a petition seems like, come on, does it really do anything? But people power is the only thing we have, really, to fight against some of the atrocities that big corporations are pushing on the administration. And so we need to let our voices be heard. Also, you know, Puerto Rico is still in a lot of need of our support. And Slow Food North Shore, which is an organization very close to my heart, the whole slow food movement is. Slow Food North Shore is the local chapter here on Long Island that I have been chairing for the last 8 years. And I'm actually stepping down along with the rest of my board. We still are looking for some people to take over our chapter, but for right now, our chapter is going to be going quiet until we find a new board, and it may be closing. But meanwhile, on Saturday, we're having a big last event, and tickets were supposed to stop being sold yesterday, but if you go on, I don't think we've discontinued it yet, and there's a few seats left. If anyone's interested, you can go to the Slow Food North Shore's website to buy a ticket. But what I wanted to say is we are collecting seeds at the event. We have a relationship with Slow Food in Puerto Rico. We've met the people both when I went down there one time and then this summer at Slow Food Nations. And we are collecting seeds to send to the farmers there. They also have a GoFundMe campaign going on to try to support the farmers who have been completely wiped out there. So if you go to their website for that, that would be really, really helpful. So also lots of other things going on in and around the news that I want to share with you. Going on actually in and around the city. Tonight, there is a Meet the Candidates night in Queens at the Bayside Historical Society. And the Northeast Queens area, they're having a Meet the Candidates night that's also going to discuss whether there should be a New York State Constitutional Convention. So that should be interesting to go to. And then on October 21st, is the event that I was just telling you about, this Saturday night, the Slow Food North Shore's Harvest Fest, which is a farm-to-table celebration. And we have great food coming from a lot of the organic restaurants in the area, including my own company, I Eat Green. We will be serving up some food. On Sunday, there's a rally to keep the soil inorganic. And this is an issue that has been coming up a lot. There's a lot of push to make vertical farming and container farming organic. And there's no soil involved in growing hydroponic vegetables. And so the organic farmers that have done a lot to really push to get their recognition are pushing back and saying, hey, wait a minute, organic is about the soil. And if you don't have soil, how can it be called organic? And hydroponic is certainly better than a lot of the conventional choices, but it is not organic. And so there's a big rally on Sunday from 4:30 to 6:30 at the Project Farmhouse, which is a wonderful new space in the city that's really dedicated to all of these new environmental sustainable issues. And it's on 76th East 13th Street. I will be there. I hope to see many of you there. Elliot Coleman will be there. Many of the organic farmers leading this movement will be there. So it should be a really interesting discussion.
Also on October 22nd, there's a Seed Sovereignty Field Day, and that's taking place up in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, which is a little bit out of our neck of the woods, but it's at the Round the Bend Farm. And again, saving seeds and sharing seeds is really something that has a lot of power and keeps us in control of the things that we want to grow. Seeds that do not have GMOs, that do not have, any pesticides in them. And it's really important that we have biodiversity in our crops. And the only way we can do that is by sharing seeds and really connecting with the other farmers that are not part of the industrial seed movement. What else? The Food Day community event is going on here on Long Island. They're all over the place. October 24th is Food Day. And here in Long Island, we're having an event at the Port Washington Library where they will be screening the film called Ingredients. Then I will be doing a cooking demo, and Patty Wood from Grassroots Environmental Education will be also leading a discussion. So that is on October 24th at 7 p.m. at the Port Washington Library. This weekend also, I forgot to mention, there's a vegan soul food tour up in Harlem. This is being put together by Motha Nature, in the Harlem community. And it's from 2 to 4, and they're going to be taking you around to all these really great vegan restaurants up in the Harlem area that are really serving soul food, just like the jambalaya I mentioned. You know, if we want to get more people to transition to eating less meat, we need to make the vegetarian food that they eat really full-flavored. You can't take someone who's used to full-flavored food and just give them a, you know, steam bowl of rice and greens and think that they're going to be happy. They're not going to be happy. And so we need to demonstrate and show examples of people creating really delicious, flavorful food that is free of meat in order to get people to be willing to do that. Another event that's going on that's really very close to my heart is the Healthy School Food Gala, and this is the Coalition for Healthy School Foods annual event. I've been participating for the last 6 or 7 years, but it's an evening with, you know, over 50 food vendors and drinks, all vegan, that that are promoting bringing plant-based foods into schools. And right now, I believe there's 3 completely plant-based schools in the New York City food system. And and speaking of food system, I did want to talk about the new free lunch program that was started this year in September in the New York City public schools, and that it's going great. You know, people were hoping that it would go this well, and I think everyone is really pleasantly surprised. They have been able to free up people's time of collecting money and the stigma involved in getting a free lunch, and everybody is able to participate and eat better, and it's just really doing wonders now. So that's was an experiment, and it's really proving to be really wonderful. But anyway, if you can come to the Healthy School Food Gala, that is on October 26th at the New York Academy of Medicine in New York City, and you still can buy tickets if you go to the Coalition for Healthy School Foods website. You can buy the tickets there. Greenwich Village has their own restaurant week, and I was happy to see that. I didn't actually know, but this is actually the 4th annual one. They're having an opening night party on October 26th at the J House Greenwich, which is, it's Greenwich, Connecticut. That's why I didn't hear of it. I thought it was Greenwich Village. Sorry about that. But anyway, it's Greenwich, Connecticut. If you live up that way, that should be a fun event. Also, October 28th, there is a big march called the Sandy 5 March for Awareness. And this is the 5th year anniversary of Superstorm Sandy that wiped out so much of Lower Manhattan, the Rockaways, Long Beach, New Jersey. It's, you know, and so this march is going to start in Brooklyn at Cadman Plaza, and we're going to walk over the Brooklyn Bridge and rally in front of the Alfred E. Smith houses in Manhattan. And we're trying to get thousands and thousands of people there to let our New York City legislators and our governor know that we really want legislation that is going to help protect us from climate change. You know, they have some projects that they're planning, like the Big U that's going to go around Lower Manhattan, but that doesn't do anything for the Rockaways or Long Island, Long Beach area, people that were really impacted by Sandy 5. So we really want more legislation, more projects that can help transition buildings to be more climate safe, and these are also opportunities for jobs for many people that are unemployed. We can train them, and so there's ways of making these kind of things a win-win all the way around, and we're just not doing enough for that. So please come out to the march on October 28th. I will be there. There actually will be a food and farm contingent that will be meeting. Just look for big signs with pictures of farming and food, and that's where I'll be, and I hope to see many of you there. There is also a New York City Food Loves Tech Industry Conference coming up on November 3rd and 4th. There's early bird tickets on sale right now, and this is, you know, going to be discussing from rooftop farming to, you know, all different kinds of sustainable farming. It will also be talking about the hydroponics that I mentioned before. And, you know, it's just going to be an open discussion and panels of, you know, ways that technology is helping the food industry and also questions that some of us may have as to whether it really is helping. There's a craft fair going on November 5th at the Restoration Farm, which is our local Nassau County organic sustainable CSA farm. Really great people there. So if you want to go out and do some early shopping for the holidays, that's on November 5th. And I have so many more events on my website. I don't want to take up the time now because, of course, I want to get to my recipe and share my recipe with you before I invite David George Gordon on to talk to us about his book and his cooking style. So my recipe this week is a peppercress pesto, and then once I made the pesto, I did a linguine with peppercress, pesto, broccoli, and cherry tomatoes. And this is a definite, you know, midweek recipe. You can make the peppercress ahead of time. It stores really well in the refrigerator. It also can be frozen. But I grew a whole row of peppercress lettuce, and peppercress lettuce is very, very pungent, very spicy. Tastes peppery. If you think arugula is spicy, this is really spicy. And so I was tasting and I thought, wow, this would be delicious in a pesto. So that's what I did. I harvested some of my peppercress leaves. I measured 2 cups worth, and that was really packed down, 2 cups worth of peppercress leaves packed down, 4 cloves of garlic, 1/2 cup of walnuts, 1/4 cup of olive oil, and 1/4 teaspoon of salt. And if you don't have peppercress and you want to do this with arugula, you can do that, or any other spicy green. You could even do it with Mizuna greens. But anyway, you just pulse it in the food processor until it really gets fine. I'm talking about the leaves, the garlic, and the walnuts. And you can put the salt in there, too, and pulse it until it's all really blended very well, and then slowly drizzle in the oil. And you want the oil to emulsify and really thicken the pesto. Wipe down the sides and make sure that it's all getting incorporated in, and then pulse it a little bit more. Taste it. Add a little more salt if you'd like, or a little bit more minced garlic to your tasting, and that is it. So that comes together really, really fast. And then you know, I put it over a pasta. You can use organic pasta, gluten-free pasta, rice pasta, whatever kind of pasta you like. And you're going to cook that, you know, al dente according to the directions. But you want to time it so that you can take the pasta right from the pot while it's al dente and put it into the pan and finish the cooking in the pan. So you're going to start by sautéing. Oh, first let me tell you the ingredients. Sorry. You need 1-pound package of linguine, 1 batch of the peppercress pesto, 2 cups of broccoli florets,
a quarter cup of olive oil, a quarter cup of white wine, 4 cloves of garlic chopped, 1 cup of assorted cherry tomatoes cut in half, and I just had, you know, whatever was in my garden, salt and pepper. I put in 10 sun-dried tomatoes cut into strips and 2 tablespoons of freshly chopped parsley. So I sautéed the broccoli in olive oil for about 5 minutes, added the garlic and sautéed that for a couple more minutes, added the white wine and just let that cook down for a few moments. Then I added the cherry tomatoes and sautéed that for a few minutes, added the sun-dried tomatoes and let that cook in. And when it was all together and the broccoli was cooked to your liking, then I took the pasta out of the pan and I put it right into the pan with the broccoli and the cherry tomatoes and mix that in. And then if you need a little bit more oil, you can add a little bit more oil. You can also use a ladle and add a little bit of the pasta water into the pan just so that there's some liquid. And then I added the pesto mixture. I started with a cup of the pesto mixture, then I add a little bit more, and you can, add as much of it as you want. You can add all of it if you want it really strong, or you can thin it out with a little bit of the pasta water and just add, you know, the 1 cup. And then I garnished it with the fresh parsley. And, sometimes you really need recipes that you can pull together really quickly for during the week, and this is one that really fits that model. So enjoy it. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you my guest. As I mentioned before, David George Gordon is the award-winning author of the book, The Eat a Bug Cookbook. He also has authored 18 other titles about orcas and gray whales, cockroaches, tarantulas, land snails, and the Sasquatch. New York Times even called his field guide to the slug gripping. He's been featured in the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Time Magazine, National Geographic Kids, and has appeared on many TV shows, including Conan O'Brien, The Late Show with James Gordon, and The View. I'm really excited to have him on to talk to us about the future of eating bugs in this country. David, are you with me?
I am. How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Oh. Great. Nice to talk to
Good.
You.
Good. Good. Well, I'm excited to have you on because, as you probably caught from some of my talking, you know, eating bugs is not something that I've ever done. And it might be in my future. I'm not really sure, but I'm inviting you on to talk to us about bugs and how you got started with this and whether you really think there's a future here in America for eating bugs. So let's start with how you got started.
It's interesting. I actually wrote the Eat a Bug Cookbook. It was published in 1998. It was revised and updated a few years ago. I got interested. I've been eating bugs for 20 years. That's the fact of the matter. I got interested in this when I started reading about how other people around the world. And the fun fact is 80% of the world's cultures eat bugs. And I started, it kind of struck my curiosity. Why don't we eat bugs? It's a subject that's been written about a lot lately. And, I started looking at all these different cultures and the way that they prepare these things. And it was fascinating to me. I decided to write this cookbook. And, that was kind of a life changer. After the book came out, I was on a lot of TV. You mentioned Conan O'Brien, for example. And then I started doing cooking demonstrations. And I've done demonstrations at this point all around the United States and even a few foreign countries. So it's kind of become my thing.
Uh-huh. And how do they taste? What are people's reactions to them?
One of the things I should say, and let's get this on the table right away, in our culture, and I'm going to say Northern European culture, we have a really bad attitude about insects and their kin. We think they're all germy and disgusting and creepy crawlies and all that sort of stuff. Well, of course, that's not true. And in fact, if the insect world were suddenly to disappear from our planet, we would be in big trouble. I think they say that, the systems that we rely on would shut down in a matter of weeks. So they carry really important, many really important roles in our world. So getting people over that bias, oh, yuck, a bug, and getting them into, oh, yum, a bug, is a lot of work just because of their, predisposition. A lot of bugs have really interesting flavors. Some of them in particular might taste like seafood. Crickets, for example, have a very mild shrimp-like flavor. You mentioned shrimp pad thai. I think cricket pad thai would be a really good way to go. Some of them have really dramatic flavors, and I'm thinking about, they sell these in Thai grocery stores, giant water bugs. Hard to describe. They almost taste like I was telling someone the other day, like a Jolly Rancher green apple flavored candy. So
really?
A whole range of different flavors. Yeah, that's part of the reason they're such a popular item in places like Thailand or Cambodia. You can actually buy the essence of a giant Thai water bug in a store, a little dropper bottle, so you can start adding that to your food. Pretty wild. But a lot of them have, you don't want to bury them with exotic flavors. So it's nice to, in my book, most of the recipes, the bugs play a really prominent role. You can't escape them, and you actually get a chance to taste them rather than the garlic butter that they're served in.
Right. Because I've had on one time before, I had a woman on who was doing cricket flour and making cookies as a way to first softly introduce the idea of eating bugs into our society. Because, all of a sudden you had cricket flour, and it was gluten-free, and it was, paleo, and all these other diets that people are becoming more popular these days. And, but it was certainly a way of introducing them while masking them. And you're really taking a whole different approach where you're making them front and center.
Yeah, that's true. When I wrote my book, I really wanted people to be aware, and I basically wanted them to be connoisseurs. Like if you go to, Rwanda or Uganda, and people are eating grasshoppers, they're very specific. Not any old grasshopper. This kind of grasshopper, they taste the best. So I really wanted to cultivate people's sense of what counts as good food and what they like. I like crickets, but I don't like mealworms. I want people to be very specific. The idea of putting a powder into your pancake mix or brownies or smoothies even, it's a great idea. And actually, you're getting all sorts of vitamins and minerals and omega-3 fatty acids, all sorts of great health benefits just by adding that to a lot of our foods that it might be a little more dubious at any rate, in terms of their health benefits. That's a good way to go, but it's not really my thing.
Right, right. So of all the bugs that you cook with, which are the most nutritious and which are the most tastiest?
I would say if I were just going to start out tomorrow cooking bugs, I definitely would work with crickets. You can buy crickets that have been raised for human consumption. This wasn't the case when I wrote my book in 1998. In fact, I was ordering crickets from the same people that supply pet stores and bait and tackle shops. Now there are people that are raising crickets on very large farms across the United States and in Canada. And these are actually raised organically. And like you mentioned, you can get gluten-free crickets now. So that's a really good kind of the coin of the realm. Someone has actually jokingly called this the gateway bug, something that gets started on. The other thing that's nice is you can even order ones at different age classes. I personally like 4 or 5 week old cricket nymphs. They're baby crickets, and they don't have their wings yet. So less roughage, basically, when you're eating them. Things that are moving up the scale, though, things like grasshoppers or locusts. A lot of people are surprised, John the Baptist, he lived on a diet of locusts and honey, if you read the New Testament. But even in the Old Testament, it mentions that locusts are considered kosher foods. So you can eat locusts and still be a devout, dietarily a devout Jew.
Mm-hmm.
you also get lots and lots of protein from them. They say that dried grasshoppers, pound for pound, are about the same as a lean ground beef in terms of the amount of protein you're getting. So good way to go. And, you know, that those omega-3s and also things like vitamin B12. I know a lot of vegetarians go to great lengths to get a vitamin B12, even injections for that matter. Well, you can get that from eating things like grasshoppers or crickets or any of the other bugs that are out there.
Really? Oh, yeah, I think, you know, you're right in that there's a lot of stigma around it and a lot of ick factor that people have to get past. But it's a cultural thing.
That's right.
It's a really cultural thing. So what dish do you prepare that you like to make for your first-time bug eaters?
You know, again, because I like to make sure the bugs are prominent and not just mashed up and buried in something. One of my favorites is taking orzo pasta. You know, orzo has actually, it looks like rice. In fact, the word itself means barley in Italian. So I like to take orzo pasta and those cricket nymphs and make a stir fry. And, you know, I always joke about this. I was giving a program at a botanical garden in Missouri, and a kid kept coming back. I made that dish. He had seconds. He had thirds. He came back for fourth. And when he came back for fifth of this dish called Orthopterin orzo, I was joking with him. I said, "Don't they feed you at home, kid?" And he said, "This is way better than anything my mom ever made." So I always use that as my greatest compliment right there. Kind of wild.
Well, it's funny because I have similar experiences. Sometimes I go to the farmers markets in some of the more food insecure areas in my area, and I'll do a cooking demo. And, you know, I'll do like the jambalaya that I was mentioned earlier in the show.
Yeah, no, that was making me hungry listening to that.
And, you know, I'll do something like that. And, you know, I'll see parents there with their kids, and the parents are like, "Oh, no, you won't like that." And the kid's like, "No, I want to try it. I want to." And they're like, "No, you're not going to like it because there's vegetables in it," right? And they think the kid doesn't like vegetables. Kids coming back for seconds, for thirds. They're loving it. And it's so interesting how we do this without even knowing it, how we pass on our likes and dislikes to our children and our preconceived ideas.
It's also unfortunate because I think in a lot of cases the children are more adventurous eaters than their parents. I get a lot of, when I do programs, parents come up to you and go, "I can't get my kid to eat anything, and here he is volunteering to eat a scorpion tail. What's the deal with that?" Well, you know, kids are excited about things like that. It's nice to get them passionate about stuff. And I definitely enjoy working with kids. You know, Dr. Seuss, Theodore Geisel once said that adults are obsolete children. And I totally believe that. The kids are definitely more likely to try my cuisine than their parents.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. David, let's take a couple-minute break. When we come back, I want to talk about some of the environmental benefits of eating bugs and what you think the future of that here could be. So everyone listening,
Sounds great. Don't
go anywhere. I'm talking with David George Gordon, author of the Eat a Bug Cookbook, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
I'm Glenn Ford.
And I'm Nellie Bailey.
Co-hosts of Black Agenda Radio. And you're listening to
PRN,
your source for progressive political viewpoints.
Truth to Power is a weekly program every Friday at 4 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network. I'm Charles Ortlieb, and I was the publisher of New York Native, the first newspaper to cover the AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome epidemics. Each week, I'll open up Pandora's box of controversial questions about what AIDS really is and what causes it. I've been covering this wild and crazy story for 36 years. I've known all the players involved with this unresolved issue. Join me each Friday at 4 as we turn the AIDS and chronic fatigue syndrome epidemics upside down. Someone has to cross the river.
Jordan. Someone has to find a way to save the day. Let this be the hour to speak truth to power.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Everyone, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, David George Gordon, talking about eating bugs. He is the author and chef of the Eat a Bug Cookbook and many other books, and we're talking about the future of eating bugs in this country. David, you with me?
Yes, I am.
Great. So right before the break, I was asking you, what are some of the environmental benefits of eating bugs?
You know, it's amazing to me. Bugs are being touted as a superfood. And, you know, a lot of that is because of the nutritional aspects. But in actuality, the real advantage is, you know, when you look at things like raising cattle, for example, or pigs, or even chickens, it's an incredible amount of waste that goes into that. There's a lot of, if you give something like 12 pounds of grain to a cow, you'll be lucky if you get 1 pound of meat. I mean, that's not a very good trade-off there. I know there are islands in the Indonesian archipelago who could really use those 12 pounds of grain just to feed the people that live there.
Right.
So that benefit of it takes about 2 pounds of grain to get about 1 pound of cricket. So it's much better trade-off there. Or grasshoppers, for that matter. The thing is that even more shocking to me is the amount of water that goes into a pound of steak. Now, you probably looked this up yourself. Almost 2,000 gallons of water go into that 1 pound of steak. You know, water is a finite commodity on our planet, especially, you know, drinkable water. And the idea of squandering all of that just to raise, you know, a small amount of protein is kind of shocking to me. So again, there's some insects out there that don't even require water at all. Mealworms, for example, are, you know, they've evolved to live in super dry conditions. They get their water by breaking down carbohydrates. So that's also a not much, much better bet as far as actually feeding people. There was a report that came out in 2013. It was published by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN. And in it, it's a big document. It's like 180 pages. They're talking about why we should all be raising insects for food as an alternative source of protein. As our population of this planet continues to grow, they're projecting there'll be another billion people here by the year 2050. So over the next 40 years, we're going to be sharing our resources with yet another billion people. And the only way we'll be able to do that, this report maintains, is by bringing out alternative sources of protein, you know, as opposed to the usual, you know, chicken, beef, or turkey kind of thing. And they're really pushing the whole idea of farming insects. I find that fascinating, the whole idea of farming. A lot of those cultures we were talking about earlier who eat bugs on a regular basis, those are wild harvested bugs for the most part. People go out at bright times of year and bring home, you know, a basket full of caterpillars or what have you. So the idea of actually farming them in controlled environments all over the United States, for example, that's a really good way to go.
Mm-hmm. However, you know, in what I've seen, you know, if you have, you know, livestock that's being grass-fed, you know, it's a much healthier product, obviously, than industrial cattle that's being raised grain.
I would think that you
probably have the similar type of thing. I mean, if you start industrializing the raising of bugs,
what will happen to the nutritional value? How will we feed them? You know, what do they normally eat when they're out in the wild compared to what we're going to be feeding them when they're being raised on an industrial scale?
Well, that's definitely an issue. Most of the cricket farmers and mealworm farmers that I've talked with, they're very conscientious. And one of the things that I really like about the way they're raising things like crickets right now is they're also using a lot of plant bases that would normally go right into our dumpsters. You know, we're an incredibly wasteful nation in terms of what we do with our food, and a lot of it just, you know, gee, that lettuce doesn't look so good, and it just gets disposed of. It's a real tragedy, really, when you consider how many people are grappling with hunger worldwide. The nice part is you can actually reclaim some of these things that would ordinarily go into the waste stream. I mean, I'm not talking about food that's past its prime, but stuff that just doesn't look so great. And the crickets will definitely enjoy that. So I think it's actually, if we're conscious, if we're not just, you know, trying to go for mass production. If you ever look at an animal feedlot, it's a disgusting thing. You would not want to eat anything that came out of those feedlots. If we can actually raise crickets and mealworms and other insects, easy to raise insects in, you know, friendlier conditions for them, we'd definitely be ahead of the curve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm such a skeptic these days. You know, I just feel like, you know, you said, you know, the people that are raising the crickets now are conscious. Well, yeah, the people that have started all of the organic businesses start them from a consciousness that because they want to do something good, and then they get bought out by the big corporations, and they, you know, change the recipes, and they manipulate it, and it ends up not being what it started out being. Just like, you know, for instance, the rise of milk. You know,
that's life in America, isn't it?
It is. It is. You know, so, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, once you get it up to it, if you're really going to start looking at bugs as a way to feed those extra billion people, well, it's going to become an industrial situation, and corporations are going to, you know, see money signs, and they're going to get in there, and they're going to figure out how to feed them with some magic food that is,
you know, the nice part of this, though, is they're scaling a lot of these things, so you can actually do it yourself. You don't even need to rely on a large farm. There's a company that's manufacturing a thing called The Hive, and it's sort of like a large version of Mr. Coffee. I mean, you can put it in your kitchen in the corner, and it's a mealworm farm. You can actually raise mealworms right from their eggs into their, you know, these are basically, by the way, for people who don't know about mealworms, they're not worms at all. They're actually baby beetles. So very rich in fats and protein and all that other good stuff, vitamins and minerals. And the idea of raising them yourself, of course, you have, you know, control over your own destiny that way. That's a kind of an experimental project right now, but I bet it'll go mainstream over the next, I don't know, 5 or 10 years.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah, you're probably right. You know, and the more, you know, I'm always talking to people about starting to grow their own vegetables. I mean, you know, the more that people take back these, take back the control of their food, the better they're going to be. So whether they're raising bugs or food, you know, farming or chickens or bees or whatever, the way we have control for our own destiny is really taking it on ourselves.
That's right. You know, at one point I had these things, they're silkworms. You know, silkworms are among the oldest of domesticated animals. People in China used to, you know, they're a cash crop raising the silk, the producers of the silk that they're going to wear. And I had these small silkworm caterpillars. They eat mulberry leaves. I gave them to my daughter who was in college at the time. And, you know, you have to keep feeding them fresh mulberry leaves. So it became kind of a labor-intensive thing for her. But her entire dormitory at her school, they were fascinated with watching these things grow. You know, it was not only a great way of creating a food source, but it also was kind of a, what we say, an outreach benefit for people to actually get involved in the stages of the life of an insect like this. Eventually, they form those cocoons, which are wrapped in silk. That's where that whole thing begins. But watching them grow and grow and grow was fascinating for the people in this dormitory.
Mm-hmm. And what about from a animal rights perspective? Do bugs feel? Are they in pain? I mean, I know that I've heard about they freeze the crickets first before they cook them so they don't feel anything. I don't know. Can you explain to us a little bit about the suffering that the bugs might be going through?
You know, it's really hard for us to relate to other animals in terms of, I'm always seeing who's smarter, a whale or a pig or whatever. I'm like, we can't even measure intelligence within our own species, let alone go with other species. And I've seen debates back and forth. Scientists would say insects are not capable of experiencing pain the way we imagine it being. And I don't know if I totally agree with that. I think basically when you're taking a life, you're taking a life. And that life could be a carrot or it could be a cow. You know, it's just a question of scale there. So when you're talking about actual animals, there's probably some degree of sentience even in something like a beetle, let's say. It's hard to measure that. I will say this, though, when you do actually freeze these bugs prior to using them in a recipe, basically they're cold-blooded animals. So as they get colder, they start slowing down. Their functions slow and slow and slow. Eventually, they sort of drift off into a deep sleep. It's kind of like a Jack London story in that way. So I don't think they're getting a lot of pain from that process. At least that's what I would tell myself.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. It's hard to know, right? It's because then you think, well, bugs are so little and you have to kill so many more to make a dish, you know.
Yeah, right. Well, a life is a life. You know, it's interesting in feudal Japan when Buddhism started to flourish on that series of islands in Japan, all of a sudden there became a real interest in eating insects. You can look back historically at this. And that was because of the whole Buddhist, you know, what do they call it? Ahimsa, causing the least amount of harm to other creatures. So, you know, rather than making a sheep suffer, the idea of making insects sacrifice their lives was a little more palatable for them.
Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I mean, there's so many insects that are doing such important jobs that we don't even know what they are. I mean, you know, that's one of the issues with the whole soil in the organics. You know, if you don't have, if you're not growing food in soil and you're not getting all that nutritional benefit from the soil and all the microbes and the energy bugs that live there that have specific jobs that they do under the soil there, what are you missing when you're growing vegetables hydroponically, you know?
Yeah, right.
You know, and I have a question also. What happens with, you know, if we really start cultivating or wanting to eat bugs, is there a risk? I would think there is a problem of becoming deficient in certain bugs and, you know, they become, on the endangered species list, you know? If we do away
it's funny.
Some of the bugs.
Right now, we just finished I live in Seattle, with a Seattle Mariners baseball team. At their stadium, Safeco Field, they were serving these things. They're little grasshoppers from Oaxaca, Mexico, called chapulines. And they're actually roasted and seasoned with chili and lime and things like that. Well, I was amazed. They started selling these at one of the kind of Mexican-themed cantinas that was serving people at these games. So, you know, wow, now people are actually not only showing that they're interested, but they're zealous about this. The first several games, they just totally sold out. They're like over 300 portions a game. Well, this is great. And actually, I found out from the person who ran the stall, that they served something like over 1,500 pounds of these chapulines, the small grasshoppers. That's a lot. And I will tell you this, all of them were wild harvested. All the chapulines coming out of that part of Mexico are actually harvested from the wild. They're not farmed or anything. It, to me, I'm like looking at that level of consumption. It's almost like here we go again with, you know, the sardine crash, the great sardine crash in Monterey Bay, where there used to be zillions and zillions of these small fish. And all of a sudden, gee, we can't find any. So you're absolutely right, if, especially for wild harvested foods. And like I mentioned earlier, that's really where most of the indigenous cultures of the world that are eating bugs are, you know, they're going out to the right tree at the right time of year. We really need to look into ways of making this a sustainable and a more closely monitored harvest if we can. You know, I was amazed to learn there really isn't any form of the Mexican government that, and no branch of the Mexican government that's looking into the harvest of these chapulines. They just, it's a traditional food. People have been eating them since before Columbus arrived.
Then another question that arises for me is, you know, when I travel, you know, you're not allowed to bring anything from another country, anything agricultural, any plant even, into the country because they're afraid you're going to be carrying some bug into the country that's not indigenous here, or, you know, there's all those, you have to sign those papers and customs. So if they're collecting all these grasshoppers wild and they're bringing them here, don't you think that they make them spray them or something to them to make sure that there's not some disease on them before they bring 1,500 pounds of grasshoppers from Mexico into the States?
Yeah, I'm not really seeing that much. You know, it's funny to me, the actual real issue in all of the chapulines, and people don't talk about this that much. A lot of times, have you ever gone to like a, a gift store or something, they're selling imported goods, you know, craft store or whatever, and you see this really beautiful pottery from Mexico, and they say, do not use this for food. In other words, it's to look at. It's because there's actually lead in the glaze of the pottery.
Right.
And for a while, people who were bringing chapulines into the United States were bringing them in. They were processed in that lead pottery. So what a surprise. They actually had lead in them when they did testing of them. And nowadays, they're getting a lot smarter, and they're, you know, acing that out. But heavens to Betsy, what terrible way to poison yourself by eating, you know, for a novelty, by eating these grasshoppers.
Right.
Well, yeah,
like I said, I would think that in order to get them through customs, they're making them do something to them.
Well, actually, the way they get
one of the problems with our food system is there's not full disclosure and transparency. So you don't really know what, you know, they might be wildly harvested, but then are they sprayed with a pesticide before coming in to make sure that they're not, I don't know.
Yeah, or even for that matter, harvested from fields where they were using pesticides. And, you know, the United States is great at selling what we no longer use ourselves, outmoded pesticides. So we sell those to other countries. So and that comes back, it's going to come back to us through the bugs that are harvested from the wild. It's a tricky business.
Yeah.
I always tell people when I give cooking demonstrations, the biggest concern isn't, you know, is this bug any good for me? It's like, where did it come from? And if you're going to go out into a field and, you know, use a sweep net and harvest grasshoppers for your own good, and I certainly have done that, you want to go somewhere where people are not using herbicides or pesticides, because that's going to basically accumulate as you eat them.
So basically what we're saying is we don't really know, correct? I mean, like if you're eating wild harvested grasshoppers that are coming in from Mexico, we really do not know what they're doing to them.
Yeah, that's really true. I'm sorry to say, but I personally don't believe you should be wild harvesting much of anything. You know, if you just keep taking without putting something back, you're going to run into problems. We've seen that time and time again with our fisheries, for example. So, yeah, you need to figure out some way of – it's amazing how much energy is going into keeping the various stocks of salmon in the Northwest healthy. And we keep wiping one out after another, even though we have all this, you know, federal programs, state programs, all that just trying to keep those runs healthy.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Wow, interesting. Lots to think about, lots to think about. So are there any bugs that you don't like to use that give you the creeps?
You know, it's funny. First off, I should say bugs that are not safe to eat, a lot of times they give us really big clues. You know, leave me alone. The really brightly colored ones, like a ladybug, for example, is bright red with black spots. It's obviously not trying to hide and blend in with the wild. So that's actually a sign in nature like, hey, I don't taste good or I might be poisonous. If you see a caterpillar and it's got alternating orange and white and black stripes, that's a sign that this caterpillar is not going to be something to eat. So that's a good way to go. Just look at the color patterns and the vibrancy of the color. But, you know, as far as the creeps goes, I'm a pretty open-minded person. I have a pet tarantula spider right now named Wilbur, who I like a lot. But I was going to say, these really giant ones that I've had the biggest problem with, two things. One is these really giant centipedes. You can buy centipedes that are from South America or Southeast Asia. They're about a foot long. And, you know, of course, they've got all those legs, 48 legs, wiggling away, and they scurry and all that. When I've gotten live ones, it's actually been kind of a contest for me how quickly I can get them into the freezer so I don't have to deal with them. They give me the
Oh, God, I could see them. I could see them serving those things on those long hot dog rolls. Oh, God.
Yeah, right, exactly. A lot of times you see them on skewers in Chinese markets. The other thing is these very large caterpillars. You probably have them yourself in New York. They're tomato hornworms. They're very large. They're about, I'm going to say about 3 inches long. They're bright green. They live on tomato plants. They're pretty tasty. But I remember after when I was working on my book, even after a year of testing recipes, when I got to the it's time to eat the large green caterpillar, I could see my could sort of hear my stomach going, really? Are you really going to eat that? So even in my own levels, I had sort of like a bar set of where where I draw the line.
So
it's kind of funny.
We're just about out of time, David. I can't believe it's gone so fast. No. Can you share with my listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Oh, absolutely. You know, my website is simple. It's just davidgeorgegordon.com. So my name, davidgeorgegordon.com. And once you get onto that site, there's a send me a message or what have you. You know, I'm a writer, and a lot of my writing is solitary. So I like being, quote, bothered by people with questions or observations or whatever. So
well,
I encourage them to send me an email.
If you could research a little bit about that, the issue of what happens to the wild harvested crickets when they come in, are they treated? I'd be very interested to find that out. But David, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really eye-opening, I think enlightening for many of my listeners. And I really appreciate you joining me. Thanks.
I have to say, bon appetit.
Bon appetit. And to everyone listening out there, have a great rest of the week. Sign-ups for my Thanksgiving feast are online now. If you want to participate in volunteering to feed the homeless, please join me at ieatgreen.com. You can sign up. Have a great rest of the week and see you again next week. Bye for now.